Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, April 10th, 2014, and this year is just flying by already, goodness. I have a few things to, first of all, read here. This is a Monsanto company, let's say it's a flyer that is put out by Monsanto. And this is there, it's called Liberty Link Roundup Ready to Technology. It's a statement by Monsanto. It says, now listen to the wording of this. I can hardly believe this, but anyway, it says, Monsanto Company is a member of Excellence Through Stewardship. Now, can you believe this, what these people think? And that's a registered title that they have. A trade registered title, Excellence Through Stewardship ETS. I wonder what MBA got a big promotion for making that one up. Anyway, it says Monsanto products are commercialized in accordance with ETS product launch stewardship guidance and in compliance with Monsanto's policy for commercialization of biotechnology-derived plant products in commodity crops. Wow, that's a mouthful, even for an MBA, whoever wrote that. Once again, I'll read it again. It says, in compliance with Monsanto's policy for, these are all capital letters, so this is a title, in compliance with Monsanto's policy for commercialization of biotechnology-derived plant products in commodity crops. Then it says this product has been approved for import into key export markets with functioning regulatory systems. Listen to this. It has to go into a country or import market where there is a functioning regulatory system. In other words, they get in there, they create the system which allows their products in, keeps other ones out. When I tried to ship my seed corn, remember a number of years ago I was selling the non-GMO seed corn, they would not allow it into Australia because Monsanto had already gotten in there and blocked any competing seeds from being allowed into Australia. I mean, can you believe that? This is, anyway, I will continue reading. It says, any crop or material produced from this product, that is any offspring corn, etc. This is talking specifically about corn. It says any crop or material produced from this product can only be exported to or used, processed, or sold in countries where all necessary regulatory approvals have been granted. It is a violation of national and international law to move material containing biotech traits across boundaries into nations where import is not permitted. So they're telling their growers and distributors that don't cross those boundaries. We're not allowed there. And by international law. So at any rate, I just wanted to read this because this is Liberty Link is the registered trademark. And then, of course, Roundup Ready is the seed, the hybrid seed, which is Roundup resistant. You can plant it, put the Roundup on, the Roundup will kill everything else and only let that particular plant grow corn, soybeans, etc. Anyway, enough time on that, but that I feel is important because of the battle, the literal battle that's going on in the world today over Monsanto is the king of all of this, and then there's the other companies, many other companies dealing with this. This is a note from a listener, and wanted to comment. And I should mention, preface this by saying, many times it's like a classroom. If somebody asks a question, that means that other people would be asking the same question. So anyway, the comment is about I talk in my work about the return current sheet that balances the electric current in the solar system. You cannot have protons going out in excess forever, building up and building up an immense charge. Eventually, it would stop. But you have to understand too that this is something like a Van de Graaff generator. If you've ever seen one of these, it's like a pole, and on the top is a round spherical metal shell, and you have a belt, a rubber belt running up and down in the middle of this, and this is distributing electrons, and what they do is they try and get to the outside of the shell. And the more you put there, it doesn't matter how many you put there, you can keep putting more and more out on the outside of that bell. And so anyway, the idea here is that the sun works very much the same, except it's doing it with protons. It's the positive charge that's going out in the solar wind. And so the listener comment deals with the return current sheet and also asking if there's something like an influx of helium, hydrogen, low mass atoms into this process. And so, yes, absolutely, I talk about this in my work. There's a calculation. In fact, a guy came to me who was an engineer. He came to me at an American Geophysical Union one time. I had a booth at the American Geophysical Union meeting. And this guy came up. It was kind of a low time, not many people around. And he said, he had presented his concept to people at NASA and got kind of shuffled away, so to speak. But he said, just do a calculation on the mass transfer, E equals mc squared, the transfer of, or the change of mass into energy that would be required if the sun were powered by the nuclear fusion core, as is stated in standard scientific theory. He said, if you calculate this and simply look at the mass conversion and the amount of light coming out of the sun, said the sun mass would burn up much sooner than 4.5 billion years. In fact, it'd be very recent. And that doesn't even account for the mass loss due to the proton wind that's coming off the sun, or the solar wind, as it's called. And the standard science, of course, believes that the solar wind is neutral, equal number of electrons and protons. And I've shown that, no, it's has an excess of protons in the solar wind. And so the issue here is that since the sun does not have sufficient mass to drive the amount of light we see coming off the sun, then, and also the fact that I talk about the solar fusion being at the surface of the sun, not at the core, you put all these together, and it turns out that clearly if the core of the sun doesn't have enough mass to convert into energy, then certainly the atmosphere, which is much less massive, certainly it would not have enough mass to convert into energy to produce the light we see coming off the sun. So what is going on? Obviously, there has to be an influx of light, low atom, a low atomic mass atoms, helium, hydrogen, deuterium, whatever, space deuterium, which is a little different than the deuterium we find on Earth. But quantities of these low periodic table elements coming into the sun for a constant burning. And so absolutely, yes, this has got to be going on. And you could imagine it something like this. The sun, in fact, is a comet in the galactic scenario, where the galactic nucleus is putting out a proton wind just like our sun is, because the galactic nucleus is a fusion-based entity. There's some other higher energy activity going on there, but basically it's a fusion-based engine. So the end result is that we are a comet. We are discharging the galactic capacitor. And by the way, this is what happens when quasars approach galaxies. They discharge the capacitor, charge up to a high negative potential, and that is the cause of the redshift. I'm going to be talking a little bit in this show about standard science and the expanding universe fairy tale science. And to understand what's really going on, you have to understand that the quasars are putting out a much higher electric field, and that's the induced electric dipole redshift. That's also in my work. the red shift, which you can show in a laboratory, by the way, very easily to show in a laboratory. I've done it with many students. The sun is discharging the galactic capacitor, and so therefore is acting like a comet, and therefore is drawing in large quantities of especially hydrogen and, like I say, low periodic elements that are low in the periodic table, and clearly the other elements also, nitrogen, oxygen, carbon, and the other elements that would be free in the atomic form out in outer space. So this is an ongoing process. So anyway, thanks for the question from a listener. And let me see, you just mentioned a first name here, if I can find it. Ed, oh yeah, Ed Edward wrote that letter, and I appreciate those comments from listeners. Here's an article that somebody sent in from a February 16th issue of the Kansas City Star, Sunday issue. It says, solar plant opens amid doubts on technology's future. And so it says, some analysts say that similar large-scale projects may not even be completed. I'll just give you a little bit of statistics on this. In Nipton, California, out in the Mojave Desert, the Ivanpah solar plant stretches over more than 5 square miles of the Mojave Desert, almost 350,000 mirrors the size of garage doors tilt towards the sun with the ability to energize 140,000 homes. That's the estimated capacity of the system. And so it reflects the sun up to a giant boiler that's around 350 feet up in the air on a pedestal. All of these mirrors over a 5-square-mile area reflecting the sun, and clearly that's a lot of energy, but 140,000 homes. The problem, of course, for this $300 million venture is that the sun only shines for part of the day. And so as the sun goes down, the ability of these mirrors to actually reflect a large quantity of the sun's energy up towards his post goes down, diminishes. But the end result is the cost, the enormous cost of this system to produce commercially viable electricity. That's a problem. And I deal in alternative energy myself. And the next topic I'm going to talk about is just another example. But these mega projects, in my way of seeing them, would be like putting up even a dam would be a better idea, but a dam relies on rainfall. I visited the Hoover Dam many times, and the last time I was there a couple years ago, it was bone dry. No electricity, folks. The tower where the water should fall down in through the dam is basically standing up there like a big pillar out in the middle of this little mud pond. So there's your Hoover Dam, folks, about a 500-megawatt facility, which really is not much. That's about the size of a single coal-operated generator today, a small one. And I believe there's, for example, there's about 9 of those around the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area to provide power. There's some other nuclear plants there. Nuclear plants are running in the range of around 500 megawatts on average. And so, anyway, it just gives you an idea of what kind of scale is necessary for these types of alternative energy. But the problem is that even in spite of the massive investment that goes into these, each one that is funded has its own particular problem. In the case of solar plants, the sun only shines during the day. What do you do at night? Well, you got to crank up your standard plant. Or you could move this solar power across the country, convert it to high voltage, and then move it around the country during the daytime. But then again, we need localized power. So the solar power scenario, I frankly don't think we're going to see many of these dotting the countryside. The other thing is, if it rains or if it's cloudy, the power output goes way down. So they always quote these. For example, it has the ability to energize 140,000 homes. Well, that's swell on a sunny day, but if it's not sunny, then gee, as the clouds move in, you got to crank up your regular coal-fired plant in the area, or nuclear, whatever the case may be, and balance that against against nature, the whims of nature. So at any rate, but the one point I want to make, that all of the technologies that are funded are literally boondoggles. They are things that will not solve our energy problem. So then the next topic I want to talk about, this one was sent in email by a listener, and it's a inflatable tunnel, basically, with a three-blade wind generator strapped to the middle of it. And it looks kind of like a big, somewhat pregnant jet engine with fins on it that they float up on cables. Now, this was the brainchild of some engineering staff at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And once again, now they're marketing this. It actually is going to be used up in Alaska for reserve power out in some remote areas. But here's the problem. In the video scenarios they showed of this device up in the wind, and it floats up a couple thousand feet in the air, and the concept is that you get many times the wind up high than you do down at the ground. And so by putting your wind generator up much higher, you will get much more power out of a smaller unit. So that's why they're floating this on an inflatable, it looks like a jet engine from a jet aircraft, but just inflated with some fins on it and then some tethered ropes. One of the other problems with any wind generation system, or any alternative wind generation system, is the run of cable that comes directly from the unit. Now, if you've got a 2,000-foot run of cable, first of all, the cable can't be very big because it's being held up by your inflatable device. So you have relatively small cable associated with this. So you can have a lot of loss just getting that electric energy down to the ground, where you could ship it out to the end user. Second of all of the videos of this showed it on a perfectly calm day with the system up there nice, just floating in the air, just nice as could be. And it appears they even had to animate the propeller blades going around because the wind was so calm. But let's try this baby on a windy day when you've got 80, 90 mile an hour winds up there at a couple thousand feet, and those winds are gusting and whipping around. boys and girls, this baby's going to be one kite that's going to go ripping away, and bye-bye system. It's not going to work. And additionally, you're going to have wind that's coming in at all directions and whipping this around. It depends, of course, on the wind coming down this short tunnel for this device. It depends on the wind coming in straight. The other thing with the three-blade systems is they are notoriously bad at high wind speeds, because it's nice to imagine that you have 5 to 8 times as much wind energy because of higher velocity winds at those altitudes. But the problem is that the three-blade systems are extremely inefficient. They suffer from vibration. If the wind is gusting, they will gust, they will spike, and then they will drop the energy, because the wind is not coming in at a steady rate at the propellers, or the vanes, as they are called on a wind generator, but they're basically three propellers. So at any rate, I could go on and on. But the point is that, once again, what you see, what gets funded, what gets put out there, is the myth of alternative energy, because these devices, number one, really won't work well under a wide scale of conditions, and number two, they're not going to solve our energy problem. I've done analysis of this for the energy industry and for individual companies, and the end result is we know how much energy the world consumes in a day. We know how much gas is attributed to gasoline, to oil, to nuclear, to coal. We know those subdivisions, and we also know what's attributable to wind energy, and they always spec wind energy up at the maximum level as if the wind were blowing at a constant, perfect 30 mile per hour all across the country, and it just doesn't happen. In England, they've discovered that it is about 11%. Some systems are as low as 2% of the specified energy production of wind systems. They've also found this out in the Netherlands, Holland, the northern European countries that have been trying to put wind power in. There was one day when, I believe it was the Dutch, exclaimed that they produced 100% of their energy requirement from wind. Well, they got a good breeze up on the northern coast there. But the next day, they didn't even produce 1% because the wind died down. So, their glory was short-lived. The problem is that we need distributed wind energy around the country, and it cannot be of this ridiculous three-blade design that has been NASA-approved and being pumped out into the market. So anyway, it's something that I work on in my background, and we'll have actually announcements coming out very shortly on the results of a lot of good research. But you have to, if you're solving a problem, you have to solve the problem. It would be like inventing a car that can only go 10 miles, but very efficient. But it can only go 10 miles. Well, then you'd have to have a gas station every 10 miles, and it wouldn't solve your problem. And that's the problem with a lot of this alternative energy and the systems that they are funding. Now, mind you, the systems that get funded are the ones that won't work. So put that in your pipe and smoke on it. Just a quick update on Yellowstone. This is getting rather worrisome. I was on with John Moore Wednesday morning. I'm typically on there. And here is the problem. He has information that through security channels that the government is preparing for a big blow from Yellowstone. But they're not telling the people. This is not getting out to the people. But my project, which I had stated a long time ago, to drain the water out of Lake Yellowstone, you come out over the southeast rim of the volcanic caldera, the old giant caldera that surrounds Yellowstone Lake, and run the water over that ridge, and it will dump down into the lowlands and off into the Oregon scablands. It'll be a pollution event, but if that water is to breach through a chasm and go down to the magma area of volcanic magma under Yellowstone, that will turn to steam, and that's where the big explosive volcanoes occur. The historical record for the biggest volcano in the world in history is clearly at Yellowstone, and all of the other volcanoes put together in the world don't hold a candle to this one. It's the biggie. And it's rumbling. There's been hundreds of earthquakes around the seismic region around Wyoming, around Yellowstone. So it is getting very, I would say, tenuous, more than tenuous, very scary, very dangerous. And here is what one would do. I don't know where you live around Yellowstone, but if it starts to rumble and groan, and you live anywhere within a 500-mile radius of Yellowstone, get in your car, and I would drive south. If you're on the east side of the volcano and the east side of Yellowstone, drive south as far as you can, because we can't really predict in what direction it's going to blow. But typically, one would expect the dust and ash trail to go easterly along with the trade winds. If you're west of the volcano, you want to drive west and south. If you're north of the volcano and west, drive north. And away, basically, you're driving away from the volcano. If you're on the west coast, I guess pick your poison. Which way has the fastest roads out of there and from the point where you are at? Expect that probably not as much will go west as will go east, just due to the trade winds, just due to the natural flow of the upper atmospheric winds. This could go all the way in the initial blast. The chiroplastic blast, which is the explosive blast, could go all the way into Nebraska. One time traveling through Nebraska, I stopped at a place that was a dinosaur kill area where the dinosaurs were buried in lava ash. And this was from a much smaller volcanic eruption that occurred, of course, back in the dinosaur age. And the volcano was near Yellowstone, but it was not the Yellowstone caldera that caused that particular dinosaur die-off. But the point is that as far as Minnesota or Wisconsin, you could have serious amount of damage. In other words, the ash that would come down could destroy farmland and make it basically the area uninhabitable. And then the ash cloud would start to spread out and continue around the world, causing a global cooling and pollution in rain. It would just be a giant mess. John Moore and I put our heads together, and I said, John, he would be a better person to go, an emissary to go to the government agencies and talk about my proposal to drain the water out of Lake Yellowstone and the fact that it's well within technological abilities. We have pipelines that run tremendous amounts of oil across vast regions, and so it would not be that big of a project to drain the lakes. This is not super rocket science. This is just down to earth. Moving water in a liquid in a tube and moving it from one area to another. And once you got it going down in a tube, once you got it going down the mountainside, you would get an assist from the siphoning action of the tubes. So it would really even reduce the amount of energy to drain the lake. John called the appropriate government officials, the state officials in Wyoming, and also the federal level officials that would have jurisdiction over Yellowstone Park. And he talked to one woman. She didn't even know what a volcano was. Now, you know, these are the people that you get in bureaucracy. They have their little rule book. Draining the water out of Lake Yellowstone is not on their list of things to do. And so, you know, where did this go? It went nowhere. It basically, they were all going to get back to him. Nobody ever called him back. And if they ever contacted the geologists, then clearly they work for the government. They're going to sit there with their finger up their nose, not knowing what to do either. So at any rate, it appears that there's no way to approach what you would consider the appropriate government agencies to facilitate something like this. And if one went up there and started setting up equipment and doing this, they would probably come and tell you to leave because it's not on their list of allowable activities. But here we are in a situation where if the water were drained out of there, then the volcano at Yellowstone at most would be a mild explosive activity and a shield volcano type of activity where the lava simply flows out and runs a ways instead of the explosive type of volcano that would occur if the water is left there. So hopefully I can get some activity going on that project, but I don't believe so. The other thing I mentioned is that another mega project is diverting the water from the Missouri River and the Mississippi River down to the American Southwest, creating reservoirs, natural reservoirs, where that water could be held and then used in Arizona, New Mexico. It would be used in California for food, etc. But we could use the snowmelt in a constructive manner. So what a concept, using our heads to manage water. But then now if that were to happen, then the world leaders who are trying to push us into a crisis in all manners, they wouldn't have their the water shortage and the food shortage that they created this winter through manipulation of weather, creating a severe drought in California. So at any rate, just another project that is on the books. Another one, by the way, is to harvest the water from Antarctica and from Greenland. The melting glaciers, pure, beautiful water running off into the ocean, nobody there to harvest it and bring it to the places where we need this in the world today. I have an update, a couple updates on the Gulf Coast of the United States. And so I'll start somewhat in the eastern region and talk about, I talked to a listener this week who lives in Florida over on the Gulf Coast and operates a sheep farm, which is real interesting, but something that I've been aware of for a long time and is confirmed by local residents, including this person, was that the chemtrails are being sprayed on a daily basis in Florida. And I went there to investigate, and clearly the chemtrails start about 4 or 5 in the morning. And here is what I have actually captured on video. It's a four-engine plane, so it would look like a 747. Although Boeing has made many airplanes strictly for spraying, but this is a four-engine plane with early morning. You see the four contrails coming out of the four engines, bright and clear, and then they start to dissipate as contrails do. And as the contrails dissipate, lo and behold, there are two, not four, but two very narrow chemtrail tracers that have come out of this airplane. And they eventually, of course, they dissipate, but the contrails dissipate almost completely. But the chemtrail, the two tracer trails from the chemtrails, remain almost like pencil lines, squiggly pencil lines in the sky amongst the four contrail trails that are coming out of the actual engine. So you can actually see the two small, narrow diameter chemtrails that have come out of this airplane. And they're doing crisscross patterns across the sky. Well, the end result is that this is a green chemical that's coming down. In fact, the reason I'm mentioning this goat farmer is because he has to change the water in the tanks for the animals twice per day. Now, the water comes from underground well water, and so that is a different source. But when it gets up in the troughs for the goats, twice a day it has to be changed out because it forms a green film on top of the water. So just a quick update there. But also in terms of water around the Gulf states, let me just start with a BP analysis. Now, recently I saw information that came out from a company that's doing a private investigation of the BP oil spill area underwater with a submarine, an underground underwater submarine that is going into the spill area right where the well is and looking at for animal life. Basically, there is very little animal life that you would expect to see brimming with life in the Gulf of Mexico. But around the BP oil spill area, still the very little life. And what there is, they said the fish, or what look like fish. Now, these are disfigured, distorted animals that have somehow lived through this chaos of first the oil spill and then the chemical treatment that was dumped into the water to try and offset the oil spill, distorted, disfigured, fish-like creatures that are very disoriented. They look around like they're on drugs or something. This is in the region of the BP oil spill. So this has not gotten better. It's not gone away. BP isn't like their commercials say, helping all us all. They get some guy sitting around with a bunch of people from the, looks like they're from the area, telling them how that we're all in this together and we're really going to do our best to solve all these problems. Well, the reality is that no, it's not any better. This is terminal damage to the Gulf of Mexico. But this is the out in the salt water, of course. But looking at, let's start once again in Florida, where this is an issue that's going on all over the world. 13% of the world's land cover, in other words, 13% of the world landmass has carbonate sub-rock systems. And these, with water, with age, become porous, and then the ground above them starts to sink. These are called sinkholes. And you find this any place where carbonate, typically these areas have been under the ocean at some point, and these carbonate layers can be anywhere from a foot through hundreds of feet under the surface of the ground. And then you have the ground stacking up on top of that. So if you have ground that's really solid or other rock systems on top, then that can mitigate the effects of the porosity of the carbonate systems that are way down in the below the surface of the ground. But 13% of the world's surface is covered with these. But now you take a place like northern and central Florida, up around into the panhandle of Florida, and here's the situation. They are pumping vast amounts of water from underground reservoirs to feed the water needs of the cities. And of course, this has been going on for some time. So what happens is, since most of Florida is nothing but sand, the sand dries out. Also, recently there has been a drought in the area. And so what happens is the sand dries out and it starts acting like an hourglass, where all of a sudden, now imagine that you have an hourglass, you know, this glass, hourglass with the sand trickling down. And let's just say that the sand got plugged. For some reason, the sand stopped pouring down through the little hole into the bottom chamber. And all you had to do was touch it with your finger, and then all of a sudden the sand would start dropping through the hole and your hourglass would work again. Okay, well, this is what's going on in Florida. The systems are building up pressure. Now all of a sudden somebody comes along and builds a building, a nice big heavy cement with iron reinforced building sitting on top of this. Well, gee, boys and girls, what's going on is you actually have hollow domes that are under these buildings, and these domes have been increasing in size over the years, so all of a sudden the homes start falling through. Maybe just a little piece of flooring, maybe a corner. Of course, a pool, which there are many of, they create a tremendous amount of weight, and the end result is that the buildings can sink. So this is a problem, but here's the catch. You would think, well, gee, it's okay, it's possibly a constant. Not everybody's house is going to be affected. But here's the problem. As they continue to pump water out of the underground reservoirs, leaving those areas, drying them out, bringing out the water, which causes a clear amount of pressure. If you want to understand also how this works, walk along a beach. And where the water and waves have been coming up, walk on that. You can drive a semi over that, and that will hold anything up when the water is mixed in with the sand. But walk a few feet up higher on the beach, and now try and walk through the loose sand and see what happens. It's just, it has no strength, it has no body. So this is what's going on now. The sinkhole areas are in the south central United States up through Arkansas and Missouri and into Illinois and up in some of the northeastern states. You can actually get a map. You can go online and search for a map of sinkholes around the world, and that would tell you exactly where the sinkholes are all over the world. Like I said, 13% of the world's surface is this type of rock structure. And I remember being in places in various foreign countries, and you would have pits in the ground. Mexico, it has actual cistern pits where the water has trickled down and eroded away the central region of a rock structure, and you just have they're called cenotes, but basically a hole in the ground with water in it. And these are all over the world. So the water erosion, when it does rain, causes more erosion. But let's look around to Mississippi, the Gulf states, over to Texas. And the whole issue of, for example, pumping out the Oglala Reservoir, which extends from Winnipeg down to Texas, they're getting lower and lower on water. Now let's jump over to California. They just did an analysis and they said, gee, California, in spite of the drought, is still producing the same amount of food that it always has in terms of vegetables, fruits, and those types of products that come from California. California is doing just great, they say. But then in the fine print, they talk about the fact that this is not coming from rainwater. This is coming from pumping underground water. And what happens is as the farmers start to drill down, they want more water for their farm, so they pump down a few feet farther, drive a well tap down a few feet farther, start pumping out the water, and then the guy next to him doesn't have any. So he's got to go deeper, and it's like a game of domino. It's a domino effect, a one-upmanship or one-downsmanship, if you will, where they're going deeper and deeper. It used to be they were very near the surface pumping groundwater. Now they're going down to very, very great depths. China, it was reported a number of years ago, was hitting the bottom of the barrel of its underground aquifers and was actually hitting salt water. And so that ended the pumping of water in China. But this is going to happen in California. So they're pumping water to maintain the food level, and they're going to continue, I would give it at most another year, probably less. I don't know what the near side is because I don't have all of the data, but from what I'm understanding, California is going to hit the brick wall very soon in food production, and that is going to cause the world, and especially the United States, food prices to just skyrocket. Remember that if California were an independent country, it would be the fifth largest economic entity in the world. This brings me to a topic here. Now, a lot of people are imagining building, and some might be building in these areas. And if you're in an area where they are sinkholes, what are known as sinkholes, then you know about it. And the end result is that over, say, a 50-year period, this problem is going to continue. And in the cases like Florida, where they're pumping out vast amounts of water to feed the needs of the cities, and remember, that water does not go back into the ground, they're not pumping anything in the ground to replace these aquifers, so they're basically pumping them dry. That water goes through the home or industrial system, goes back to the treatment plant, and then it's dumped off into some other, typically into a river where it goes out into the ocean. And so the water does not get back down into the water tables. And frankly, you're probably better off if it doesn't, because it's so polluted with chemicals and everything else in the planet. Pharmaceutical drugs, all of that goes into that water supply. So it's, in a sense, it's better not to put it back into the ground. But the other half of it is that if the cities keep draining the rural areas, then we're going to have, over the next 50 years, utter chaos in these regions. Also, I have to mention, now, earthquakes in Florida are probably not the most common thing that you may have heard about. However, if there were an earthquake, and sometimes the earthquakes, I was reading through the history of earthquakes around the Gulf region, and the history of earthquakes, especially the ones that might occur like in the St. Louis, Missouri region, can be felt as far away as Florida. But here's the point. If you took that salt shaker that we call sand in Florida, or around the Gulf states, this would include Mississippi, Alabama, and eastern Texas down on the Gulf, if you took and shook that sugar sand in the cavities that are underneath it, you could have a tremendous amount of damage in a single day due to a tremor that was really not that great. It's like flicking your finger just gently against that hourglass that I was talking about before. And so these are, we'll just have to wait and see. I'm not predicting that Florida is going to have an earthquake. And from historical records, really there's little earthquake activity in Florida. But the tremors that do occur there are felt from tremors that are very far away. And it doesn't take much but a little shaking to get this process going of the collapse of these domes that are forming under buildings. The situation is that it is much worse today than it has ever been before in the past because of the extensive pumping of underground water. And so that comes back to my topic of water. I keep harping on this topic of water, that the United States is heading into critical mass. Last couple summers, Atlanta, Georgia, literally had no water. There are 10 cities that they are expecting this summer in the United States to literally run out of water. And so all I can tell people is to be prepared, be your source of clean, fresh water. And along with this, you may have to move. So I want people to understand, don't fall into the trap of thinking that your under sink water filter is going to save you, because and you think that you have a water filtration product. It's not the case. Unfortunately, the tubes, there's a rule of thumb. If it connects a tube to your water filter from some source, and it connects electricity, then you do not have what you need in case of emergency. You need a water filter also that is portable. You can pick it up in a couple minutes, like with the gravity water filters that I sell. You can pick them up, dump the water out into the kitchen sink, put it into your car, into a backpack, and carry it with you. Or you could even carry it full of water. I have filtration and storage systems. And the pre-filter is something that people are finally waking up to. I have to announce this on the show. I actually put it on the webpage. We're going to make a determination tomorrow night, at the end of tomorrow. But we are at capacity and selling the pre-filters. That's the Universal Chemrad Oil Pre-Filter. We are at capacity, and we're just taking orders now that we are able to fill. And so if you're interested in one of those, I would go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. And also, of course, you need a gravity water filter to go with it. So choose one that's right for you, either the one with the giant tanks, the modular filtration and storage system. With the pre-filter fits all of these, or the stainless steel if you want to go to the high end, certainly something that's going to last you 3-4 generations, the stainless steel housing. But remember that the filter elements are the same in all of these, so you can go down to the very inexpensive plastic housing case. These are high density polyethylene plastic, so that's food grade plastic. And the filter elements are the same in all of these. You can get the plastic unit for about $100. And people are doing that, that if they don't have a lot of money, or if they want one for travel, or up at the cabin, or for camping, or for the hunting lodge, or whatever. The plastic unit for $100, I mean, you can't go wrong. And the what we call the that's with one filter element. It can come with five filter elements. I think that's about $160. But get a gravity feed water filter. And like I say, don't be led down the path where you think that an under sink water filter is going to do the job for you. The other problem is with under sink water filters is they are in the pressure line of your water. So if you do have radiation in your water, the radiation typically comes in the form, it is attached to something else like dust or oil or particulate matter in the water. But it's a very loose binding connection, and so adhesion. So the nuclear radiation atom is going to break away and flow through your system. The only product on the market which is a low pressure water filtration system made for specifically for taking out radiation is my pre-filter, and it does it by grabbing on to whatever the radiation is attached to, and it holds it there. You don't want radiation getting into your clean water filter, because once it does, it's going to start to pollute it, and it's going to start to contaminate your water filter. So you got to stop it before it gets into your water filter. I've been around water filters for a very long time, and my product line is the best. It's the least expensive, and it's going to cover all of your needs, including the part where it's got to be portable, it's got to be for emergency. If the water goes off and you have an inline water filter, you don't have a water filter. So just beware of that. There are good products on the market that do their job well, but the problem is that in case of emergency, they simply are not going to do anything. That's the problem. So like I say, if it's got a tube, if it's got electricity, it's not emergency. It's not going to work, and it's not portable. You can't take it with you. Sometimes you might be in your car someplace. You might be on the side of the road going someplace, and you have to get water and filter it and in your car while you're trying to get someplace. And this is what it's going to be like if things really come down. So you have to be prepared, folks. That's all I can tell you. I have a couple topics I want to cover quickly here. Before the end of the show, I went through a grocery store, something I rarely do anymore, but I did it specifically to talk about, and I have talked about this before, but if you go into a grocery store and you look at all those nice and neat packages up and down the aisles, and it's between the soaps, the personal hygiene products, the food that's packaged, there's literally, and I first of all, I tried to find something that didn't have GMO products in it, that didn't have preservatives, that didn't have some kind of chemical treatment, or wasn't raised with insecticides or pesticides or herbicides or whatever. And even eggs, they say range-fed or range eggs. The chickens are eating Monsanto corn, because there literally is no corn on the market that is available for chicken feed. You literally cannot find real food in a grocery store. And so I encourage people to find or develop their own source of food and plant a garden, always plant a garden. But don't depend on that. Find some source, an organic gardener, that grows good crops, and it's also, don't be fooled by the word organic. That simply meant it was not raised with chemicals or herbicides, etc. Nine times out of 10 or 99 times out of 100, it's hybrid seed that they're growing organically. So you got to really get out there and search for food. It's impossible to find good food in the United States. Just a quick update on this comet that's going to be approaching Mars, on October 19th this year. And what I'm predicting we will see, Now, unfortunately, this is a very small comet. Mars will be quite far away, although we'll get a good side view of this. It's too far away for us to see any effects on from Earth. But what we might see, if we were lucky, is this comet develop a hurricane in the atmosphere of Mars. That would be something that would be visible, possibly with relatively small telescopes from planet Earth. So at any rate, other than that, of course, NASA will have their equipment, all eyes trained on this comet, but you can be guaranteed that they're not going to be letting out any data that might corroborate my predictions. If we were close, we would probably see atmospheric glowing, where the electrical discharge from the comet starts to meet the atmosphere. We could see discharges going all the way to the surface of the planet. We could see, if you were on the planet itself, you could see the Moses-style pillar of fire going up into the sky through the atmosphere with tornadic activity, dust devils, etc., in that region. So those are all effects that would be visible if you were close by. I'll be talking more about this in the future. But the other thing I wanted to talk about was there's a lot more information trying to be pushed onto the public about the expanding universe and how fast it is expanding. It's complete nonsense. There is not a single shred of direct evidence that a Big Bang ever occurred. And really, all of the good information, the properly interpreted information, tells you that there was no such thing as a Big Bang. But once again, this is the garbage science pawned off on the public to keep you ignorant and keep you from imagining what's really going on. It also gives the scientists an out to try and pretend that there was no creator, that there's no grand design in the universe. It just all of a sudden, kahooey, there it was, boom, Big Bang, no need for God, no need for great design. And it all just happened at random. That's the standard scientific package pawned on you today. Finally, I want to encourage you to go to my webpage. It's jmccsci.com. Remember the pre-filter. It's $219, I believe, is the price for the pre-filter. And you can get the accessory sets, additional powders, and the other items that come with it, the disposable items with the pre-filter, also the water filter items. And remember, you get the two free ebooks, Water, my second to most recent ebook titled Water, tells you about the control of water that's going on in the world today, and also my latest ebook, Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit, written for the general public, talking about encryption problems and secure computing problems that affect all of us in the computer world today. So remember the webpage JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.